And then he said, I considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. Now, he's going to do that later, but at this point it seems like he's thinking of better times that he's had in the past. And I call to remembrance my song of the night. He doesn't have that song tonight. That song is not on his heart tonight. You ever find you're in a moment of sorrow, in a moment of despair, in a moment of anguish, in a moment of grief, that you think back to previous days when things were better, but you can't sing the song you sang a few days ago, or a few weeks ago, or a few months ago, or a year or two ago? And that's what the psalmist is saying here. I call to remembrance the song in the night. There was a day in which I had a song in the night long before this ever happened, if it is talking about the Babylonian captivity. But I'm not singing that song now. I meditate within my heart, notice verse 6, and my spirit makes diligent search. I have questions, and I'm searching for answers to those questions. Not so much as to why is this happening. He doesn't entertain that question in the psalm. He doesn't ask, why did this happen to us? Why did you do this to us, God? But it is a question of what's going to happen now. Where do we go from here? And are you going to leave us here? And is there any hope for the future? And is there any deliverance from this? Not why did it happen, but what happens now? And my spirit makes diligent search. I'm searching for answers to questions. And I haven't found them yet. He thinks back of better days, and he doesn't see them now. Now, in verses 7 to 9, he has questions. Here is still a part of his sigh, a part of his trouble. There are a series of 6 questions, and it seems like, and I emphasize seems, that God has forgotten his people. Notice the series of 6 questions, 2 in each verse. Will the Lord cast off forever? Now, verse 7 gives us the impression that he's talking about some national calamity. Because God has cast someone off, that is his people. And in contrast, he talks about what God did to deliver his people as a nation in verse 20. But be that as it may, that's the evidence for which there may be some national calamity. And with that in mind, he says, will God cast off forever? What God has done to us now with the Chaldean invasion and the captivity, is this permanent? That's one of my questions. Is it forever? The second question, will he be favorable no more? They're all the same question, but worded differently. Will he be favorable no more? Have we lost God's favor forever? Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promises failed forevermore? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercy? God's angry with us. I know he is. And has he shut up his tender mercies forever? Has he taken his tender mercy, instead of releasing it, shut it up and locked it in a closet somewhere where he won't let us have access to that anymore? Is that what God has done? And I want to suggest to you that in anguish of soul, you'll ask questions that later you'll come to realize that I knew the answer when I raised those questions. Job said that. Job said, don't you know a man in my condition will say things that he doesn't really mean because of the anguish of his soul? And that's what the psalmist is going through. In the midst of this national calamity, he's raising questions to which he knows the answer. And you say, how do you know he knows the answer? Because before the psalm is through, he's thought about it through the night. And he came to realize what was already in his mind. He brought it to the forefront, and that brought him comfort. And we'll see that in 10 through 12. But at this moment, he's raising questions. Have you ever got to the point you raise those kinds of questions? Has God forgotten about us? It may be something on a national scene. It may be within the church, or it may be within your life or within your family. And you wonder, has God forgotten about us? Is his mercy gone? Has he shut up his mercies against us? Oh, the psalmist has questions. But now, the song begins, as Scroggie suggests. Beginning at verse 10, having followed the sigh, here comes the song. Following the triumph of the trouble, now comes the triumph over the trouble. And so two things happen here. Here's hope and confidence based upon the past. He admits his thinking was wrong in verses 10 through 12. Let's see what he says. He said, this is my anguish. I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. You see, what he's saying in verses 10 through 12, we'll get to verse 11 and 12 in just a moment. He is saying the answers to my questions in verses 7 through 9 are found in the revelation of God Himself in history. Look at what He's done in the past. So I remembered the years of the right hand of the Most High, His power. That's the right hand of God. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember the works of old, and I will also meditate on all your work and talk of your deeds. Interesting. We'll come back to verse 12 a little bit later. But I'm going to think about it and I'm going to talk about it. Verse 12. I'm going to spend some time reflecting and meditating upon what you've done in the past. And then I'm going to tell others about that. Because this is something we're all in. We're all in this boat of this national calamity, and we're going to talk about it. And perhaps I'll share that and I'll be of help to other people when I remind them of what I've just remembered about God. So his point in verses 10 through 12 is, I realize now I was wrong in raising those questions, or I was wrong in my thinking. God has not forgotten his people. Where do you get that information? I went back to the revelation of God and how he revealed himself in history, and I look at that. What did you see? Well, beginning at verse 13 now. He talks about his comfort is in God. That's where my comfort is. I look at God and I look at his power and I look at what he's done and I look how he's delivered his people, and I know he'll deliver his people now. And so what does he say? Well, beginning at verse 13, your way, O God, is in the sanctuary, in holiness, the footnote will say, in purity. That is, he is a holy God. Who is so great a God as our God? Where my comfort came from was to reflect upon what I learned as I reflected on the past. Remember the point of verse 10 through 12? Where I found the answer to my question was remembering the things of old and going back to how God had revealed himself in history. What'd you learn from that? I learned upon that reflection, there is no God as great as our God. Verse 14, you are the God who does wonders and has declared your strength among the peoples. And you have with your arm redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. What's he talking about? Well, he's saying is, I remember how God, in a time of national calamity, where God had redeemed or delivered his people. That's the idea of redeeming your people. And he mentions the sons of Jacob and Joseph. What does that make you think of? The Egyptian captivity. There is some comparison to be made between Egyptian captivity and the Babylonian captivity, because just as God could and did deliver them from the Egyptian captivity, God can deliver them from this if they'll remain faithful. Because there will be a remnant to return. And so he said, this is the God. I begin to think about this God who does great wonders. What are you talking about? The water saw you. This is talking about the deliverance from Egypt. I remembered as I thought back, the waters saw you, O God, and the waters saw you. They were afraid. And the depths were also troubled. He personifies the water, the Red Sea, as they're crossing. And it's as if God's presence came in and the waters were afraid and the waters scattered at the presence of the mighty God. The clouds poured out water and the sky sent out a sound and the arrows flashed about. The voice of your thunder was in a whirlwind. The lightnings lit up the world, and the earth trembled and shook. Not only did the water scatter, but the whole earth was afraid of you, God. You're such a great God. Your way was in the sea, and your path in the great waters. He created a path for his people to cross, and your footsteps were not known. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. He's talking about leading them through the Red Sea. When all looked impossible that they'd ever come out of Egypt, and when they finally get to the Red Sea and it looks like maybe they're trapped, then God opens the waters and lets them escape and they're gone. And God did that by a strong right hand. And the psalmist is saying, I remembered that. And that helped me with the answer to my questions, is what that did. Well, what a great psalm that is. It seems like God has forgotten his people, but by morning he rises up and he has a different thought. And he thinks differently than he did before. So it does seem like God has forgotten his people. And I cried out to God in the midst of this national calamity, and I don't find comfort, but I think back. I'm troubled, and I can't sleep, and I think back to the past. And I have questions. And now he says, I turn and I realize those questions were not accurate, but I need to focus on God, and that's where I find my comfort, is in God. And let's spend the rest of our time talking about things we learn from that psalm that will be helpful to you and perhaps to all of us as we think about facing our own tragedies, our own grief, our own anguish of soul. How could this psalm be of help at all? Well, here's the first thing. I learned that we ought to cry out to God and we ought to express our grief. That's what the psalmist did. The psalmist is not wrong in having done that. In fact, the psalmist is right in having done that exact thing of crying out to God and expressing his grief. The preacher said in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, there's a time to weep. There is certainly a time to weep. There's a time to shed tears. There's a time when there is grief and there's sorrow and there's anguish. Jesus himself wept. You remember that at the death of Lazarus, that Jesus wept, the text said. There's nothing unmanly about weeping and shedding tears. Jesus did that. There's certainly something therapeutic about tears, and it helps to purge the heartache. And that's what the psalmist is saying. I cried out to God. I was upset about this, and I shed tears over that. And I didn't know anything to do but cry out to God about that and ask questions of God. And I learned from this that we ought to cry out to God and express our grief to him. In verses 4 through 6, here's something I learned. And that is, sleepless nights and anguish of spirit can drive us to sober thinking. Because he said, my eyelids are open. You held my eyelids open, God. Verse 4. I'm so troubled I cannot speak. So upset I don't know what to say about it. And then he said, I called remembrance the song in the night. In verse 6 now, I meditate within my heart and my spirit makes diligent search. What's his point? All of this anguish of soul and sleepless of night drove me to do some sober thinking. And I learned something important about that. We're often busy in daily life to the point we fail to think and we fail to meditate upon the seriousness and soberness of life, of what's really important. You remember the Ecclesiastes writer talked about it being better to go to the house of mourning than the feast. The idea, it's better, you gain more from sober thoughts around a funeral home than you would at a party. Because we're not thinking about the sober things of life is the point that is to be made. And we're often so busy we forget about that. Moses warned in Deuteronomy 6, you're familiar with our reading that in times of ease we forget about God when things are going well. And that doesn't make us ponder very much. But what grief and sorrow do, they promote serious thought about what's really important in life. It raises questions to which we search for answers. And if we search for answers, we find the answers like the psalmist did. So grief and sorrow and anguish is not always bad. Sometimes it's productive of good. Here's the third thing. From verses 7 through 9, I learned this principle that we ought to ask questions. Nothing wrong with that. But we ought to seek the answer to those questions. He had six questions he raised. Has God cast off his people forever? Will it be favorable no more? Has his mercy ceased forever? There is no shame in having questions and doubts. And when something arises in your life that you begin to have questions and you have some doubts about things, nothing wrong with that. The problem is there's shame to be associated with accepting the questions as the final answer. And what the psalmist did at verse 6, he said, I made a diligent search. I thought about it, and I thought about it long, and I thought about it hard. And I had serious questions, verses 7 through 9. But I looked back to God's revelation in the past, and I found my answer. Nothing wrong with your question. Nothing wrong with your doubts. There is something wrong if you let that be the final answer. Look for answers to your questions. We all have them. Number 4. I learned that a troubled soul has a narrow focus. Verses 1 through 9. The psalmist is troubled. But the reason he's troubled, he has a narrow focus. Verses 10 through 12 is a broader focus. If this were pictured as through the lens of a camera, he is zooming in and zeroed in on one national calamity for a short period of time in verses 1 through 9. In 10 through 20, he's broadened out and he's got a wider picture. And he's getting a panoramic view of what God has done all through time. And that's the difference. Scroggie said, it depicts, that is this psalm, it depicts the struggle of a soul as centered and a single night of anguish. The hammer has fallen. They are in captivity. And that's all he can think about. And for the moment of verses 1 through 9, he hasn't thought a thing about Egypt and the deliverance therefrom, or the power of God. All he can think about is the national calamity. Scroggie goes on to say that we find assurance by looking behind and before and to history and to heaven. You see, for the moment, he's looking only at the tragedy. He has a narrow focus. But finally, by the time the psalm is over, he's looked back and then he looks before. What's going to happen in the future? He looks at history and then he looks upward to heaven, to God. And that's exactly what we ought to do. Scroggie goes further to say, as he lay awake, despair and hope battled within him for mastery. And before the day dawned, a great light had flooded his soul. I get the picture from the psalm of him wrestling and tossing through the night. But by the time morning breaks, as Scroggie suggests, verses 10 to 20, he arises with a new confidence and a renewed confidence that he had come to know from his thoughts through the night. Number 5. Remember, God's power is greater than any power of the world. Remember, God's power is greater than any power of the world. The problem? It's Babylon. The Chaldeans. They seem to be even stronger than the Assyrians of the previous chapter. And the problem? They're powerful. They are a threat. And no wonder he raises these questions. But before the psalm is through, what does he say? If you've left the psalm, turn back with me there for a minute at verse 13. He said, "Who is so great as our God, who does wonders and has declared his strength among the people, and you have with your arm redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph?" He focuses on the power of God. The psalmist had seen the power of Assyria and Babylon, and nothing compares with the power of God himself. And he comes to the conclusion, there is no power like the power of our God. Whatever you're going through, there's something where you may feel powerless. There's nothing like the power of God. Number 6. What I learned from this psalm is finally, that God has delivered his people and he can deliver his people. And I learned that in verses 19 and 20. God has delivered his people and God can deliver his people. Now I want to go back to verse 12 just for a moment. I said we'd come back to that. Remember the psalmist had said, "I will meditate on all your works and talk of your deeds." Two things he's going to do. I'm going to think and we'll do some talking about it. Thinking of the past helps us. When we're all discouraged over something, and we're all going through some despair and anguish of soul, thinking of the past will help you. Talking of the past will help others. Isn't that what the psalmist is saying? I finally come to the realization that if I just think about the past, it's going to help me. And if I talk about the past, it's going to help everybody else. We're in the midst of national class. And you say evidence of that? He wrote it down for us. And he talked about it, didn't he? Helps me and you. And that's exactly what he did. He helped us. He helped us all. Now back to verses 19 and 20. In verses 19 and 20, he said, "Your way was in the sea, and your path is in the great waters, and your footsteps are not known. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and of Aaron." In other words, what I learned from verses 19 and 20, the same God that delivered from Egypt is the same God that can deliver them from Babylon. If they would just recall, Jeremiah had said, in 70 years they'll return. A remnant will come back. What makes us think that's going to happen? The same God that delivered Egypt is the same God that's going to fulfill that promise. And so what does that mean to us? Well, the same God that delivered them out of Egypt, the same God that delivered them from Babylon, is the same God that delivers us from whatever is our bondage or our troubles. You toss and turn in the sleepless night and you begin to wonder what is the answer to your anguish of soul. How can I be delivered from all this? The same God that delivered them is the same God that delivered us. Well, that's Psalm the 77th. That is the psalm itself, what the psalm is saying, and some things that we learn from the psalm. It is a great psalm. It is a comforting psalm. It is a psalm to which all of us can plug into and say, you know what, I can make some use of that somehow in my life. Because there is at some point, if you're not facing it now, you'll come across some point in your life where you'll say, you know, I feel like the psalmist in Psalm 77. I kind of feel like that. And so take the psalm, commit it to your heart, and make application of it in the future. There may be one or more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and while we sing?